The Mars rovers have really captured our imaginations. They genuinely are explorers, in the old-fashioned sense. You're listening to Western Worlds. Welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, home of the Purple Crow, in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight we have the first of what I hope will be many interviews leading up to the landing of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity on August the 5th of 2012. Curiosity will be the largest, most capable roving laboratory ever deployed to another planet. It will be more versatile and will travel further than anything that has come before. It will be able to interrogate the geology and the chemistry of the surface and of the atmosphere of Mars in ways that we could have only have dreamt a decade ago. Now, while MSL is not a life detection mission, it does have the ability to answer questions about something called habitability. That is to say, whether conditions on Mars were ever conducive to life, and whether the rocks we see are capable of preserving evidence of that life which we could detect with a future mission. It's an exciting project and an exciting prospect, especially since the Gale Crater landing site possesses what is possibly the thickest exposed sedimentary layer in the solar system. Much of Mars history could be right there, page after page, written in this stack of rocks. Ultimately, Curiosity is a big first step towards understanding whether our biology is unique in the solar system. Given the degree to which water and life are connected in our studies of Mars, it seems appropriate that tonight's music is Tree of Life, from Clint Mansell's score to The Fountain. Now, a big part of reading the habitability story contained in those rocks at Gale is an instrument called ChemCam. ChemCam combines three tools: a laser whose pulses are powerful enough to vaporize rock, a spectrometer to analyze the light that comes back to figure out the elemental composition of those rocks, and thirdly, a telescopic camera to put those results into their proper geologic context. Leading the effort to build, operate, and understand the science returned is instrument principal investigator Roger Weens of the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Remember that these rovers are operated by a group of scientists back here on Earth. Thus, Dr. Weens is one of the explorers to which Brian Cox alluded in our opening quote. And Curiosity is not his first space mission. Previously, Dr. Weens was a co-investigator on Deep Space One and developed the solar wind concentrator for Genesis. At a recent conference, our own Raymond Francis had the chance to sit down with Dr. Weens to talk to him about his work exploring Mars and the solar system.
All right, so Dr. Weens, welcome to Western Worlds. And we're going to talk a bit about instruments and space missions. In particular, the Mars Science Lab, which is on its way to Mars right now. Can you tell me, what is your involvement with that mission?
I am the PI, or principal investigator, another way of saying the leader of the ChemCam instrument, which is one of the 10 instruments on board the Mars Science Laboratory rover. And personally, I think our instrument is the most interesting, but it's one of the 10, and it is... Well, I'd still say it has more visibility because it sits up on the mast of the rover and it shoots the laser out across onto the surface of Mars in order to make measurements chemically, and then it takes close-up pictures of that as well.
Okay, so ChemCam is not just a camera, but a laser system.
That's right. ChemCam has the camera, but the camera is partially to take close-up images of the things that we analyze remotely. And the remote analysis is done with a high-power pulsed laser. And this laser actually puts, as I like to say it, it puts the energy of about a million light bulbs into the spot the size of a pinhead on the surface of Mars. And the reason we do this is that that excites a small amount of material from the surface and allows us to analyze it chemically from a distance. When this laser pulse hits, there's a flash, and we have a little telescope in the mast of the rover, and that telescope looks at this flash of light and is able to record the spectrum of that flash, and that spectrum tells us what elements are present in the rock.
Okay, and so this is the system that they call a laser-induced breakdown spectrometer?
That's right, Ray. And so laser-induced breakdown spectrometry, or LIBS, gives us this chemical composition of these small spots on the surface of Mars. It has a few advantages over other systems. First of all, it is able to basically remove the dust or even a weathering surface layer of the rock by doing multiple laser pulses, and it can do this up to about 25 feet away or about 7 meters away. And so I like to say it's like a long arm reaching out 7 meters and flicking away some dust in order to make a real measurement. That's important because rocks on Mars are typically covered by dust, and so we can get rid of that dust and actually see what's underneath, and we're not hindered by that dust layer.
So what about the weathering on the surface of the rock? Does this help deal with that problem? Or?
That's right. And so by doing a number of laser pulses, we can go up to about a millimeter deep into a rock. We don't actually blast the whole rock, but we blast away a little bit, and it's a few microns at a time. And we can get down about a millimeter. And so some rocks on Earth have weathering rinds, which is a small depth over which the weathering has occurred in. And some other rocks have weathering coatings on top of them. And these coatings are of great interest in their own because we want to know what has transpired on the surface of these rocks over the long periods of time that they've been exposed on Mars.
Right, and so would you compare the weathered surface to the fresh surface that's exposed after the laser?
That's right. And in fact, let me just say that on Earth, there are coatings on many rocks, especially out in the desert and some other environments, that we know are produced by biological materials. They're bioremediated surfaces. And so we, by looking laser pulse after laser pulse down into this rock, we're actually able to investigate whether there could have been something similar on Mars. We'll probably have to look for somewhat unweathered rocks, maybe look underneath on the bottom side of a rock or something like that, because, of course, the wind scours away things. And if this if these coatings were actually produced by possible organic material way back eons ago on Mars, they might have weathered away by the wind on the top surfaces, but maybe not on the bottom surfaces if the rock was turned over long ago. So there's lots of interesting and potentially very intriguing things that we might be able to do looking into the very surfaces of the rocks on Mars.
And is the LIBS system, the laser, is it powerful enough to do this little vaporization with any type of rock you might find?
Yes, Ray, it really works with any rock. We've gone through carbonate rocks, which are relatively soft, or sulfate rocks. We've also looked into basalt rocks, which tend to be quite hard. And the depth at which we excavate per laser pulse does vary with those. But we can go in about a micron per laser shot on basalts as well. So it really does work for these things.
So this system, part of the Curiosity rover, where is that mounted? How is it fixed to the robot?
So the Curiosity rover is well, first of all, let me just say it's a big rover.
Okay.
This thing is, it stands over 2 meters tall. It's, I can't remember exactly how wide or how long, but let's just say that it's larger than a small car. It's almost the size of a very small SUV.
Which makes it a lot bigger than rovers we've sent before.
That's right. The mass of this rover, the previous generation of rovers, the Mars Exploration Rovers, or MER, which were twins, they weighed about 140 kilograms each. And the MSL rover, which we've named Curiosity, actually weighs 900 kilograms. So it's about five times the weight of the previous generation or rovers. It's just, like I said, like a small car. And so on this rover, the laser and telescope part of ChemCam sits up in a box up on a mast. So it is really at or just a little bit above a human eye level, 2 meters off the ground. And so it's got it's a 110 millimeter diameter telescope. And if you look at the rover, it looks like a giant cyclops eye sitting up there. And so it's at a good vantage point from there to actually shoot down anywhere within 7 meters of the rover. If we shoot straight down, we're looking at the ground about 2 meters below us.
Okay. And I understand that on board the rover, you've also got a target that you can use to test or calibrate the system.
Yeah, on the back of the rover, which is about a meter and a half away from the telescope itself, there is a set of 10 calibration targets. We would have loved to have brought 80 or 100, but it just doesn't fit on the rover. So we have four targets that are simulating igneous rocks, and then we have four targets that are simulating sedimentary rock, what we think will be like sedimentary rocks on Mars. And those were actually made by taking some terrestrial clay minerals, some basaltic material, because the clay, the sediments on Mars tend to be sort of still have a flavor of their precursor basalts.
Right.
And mix those with a gypsum, which will give us more sulfur, which also is present on Mars. Mm-hmm. And that's why that's how we've tried to simulate those clay minerals for Mars. And then we have also a titanium plate on this calibration assembly. And we just use titanium as a nice calibration for the wavelength of our instrument, because it has a whole lot of different emission lines at different wavelengths. Mm-hmm. And so we can shoot at that, we can look at our spectrum and get everything adjusted right, so we can look at our data correctly.
Okay. And so is that the first thing you're going to do then when you unfold the system after arriving at Mars, is to calibrate it with that test target?
We've started planning the first days on Mars, and assuming the landing goes smoothly and everything is good, then the mast has to get raised because it's strapped down right next to the deck. And so that mast gets raised, I think, on day number two, I think it is. No, day number one, probably. And then we will take some images of the calibration targets to verify that at least the imaging part of our instrument is looking good. There's a little bit of trepidation to use the laser until we know everything is really good. And one other detail about the rover itself is that it's actually flying right now through space using the rover's computer. And so one of the first things they'll do when they get to Mars is actually reprogram the computer to actually rove, not fly through space.
All right.
And so that'll happen on day four. After day four, we're more good to go than before that. So then the next thing is to take another set of images on the calibration targets. And that's really to verify that the new software is able to point ChemCam where we tell it to go. We don't want to shoot the rover in the foot, so to speak, by bad pointing. And so after that, then on day six, if all goes well, or somewhere thereafter, we'll shoot at the Mars surface, and then on the same day, we'll probably shoot at some of our calibration targets.
Okay, and thereafter, the instrument's available for science throughout the mission?
Yeah, we'll go through a small additional set of checkouts. But as we're doing that, we'll also be shooting at some of the most interesting places that the science team says wants us to shoot at right around the rover.
Okay.
So we'll just sort of gradually move from checkout into real analyses of the surface.
Excellent. So then, is this the first time that we've had a LIBS on Mars?
This is, and in fact, it's the first time for a powerful laser like that on the surface of Mars as well, or anywhere outside of the Earth.
Okay. And so what new capability do we get for having a laser-induced breakdown spectrometer on another planet?
So I mentioned already that the LIBS has the capability to look through a dust layer and profile through weathering or any other coating on the rock. And that's a great advantage. But there's also advantages because the LIBS technique gives us emission lines from elements that we have not looked at before on Mars.
Okay.
And those elements are the most important one. By far is hydrogen. And so we're looking for water on Mars. We've seen it with other techniques, but not one that is sitting on a rover and actually detects hydrogen. Most of the hydrogen detection we've done at Mars has been from orbit, in fact.
Okay.
So this is the first time we really have an instrument that will be looking directly at hydrogen, which is, of course, present in water. It's also present in clay minerals, and those are of particular interest because they're areas where we would look for, say, evidence of organics or habitability, that kind of thing. Then besides hydrogen, we also have some of the other light elements, lithium, beryllium, and boron, and then also, interestingly enough, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. And those are, of course, also present in organics, and so they're important to us for that reason. We've got a little bit of difficulty looking at carbon because most of the atmosphere of Mars is carbon dioxide. And we do excite a little bit of the air around the sample when we create this spark or flash that we look at. And so we've got a higher, not as good detection limit for carbon as we'd like, but that's a fact of life given this technique. But we do have it, and so if we do run into a rock like a carbonate rock on Mars, we will be able to see that it does have carbon, in fact.
Now, I suppose then you're able to tell which elements and which atoms the rock is made of, but maybe not which molecules?
So geologists are interested in two things that really characterize rocks in terms of composition. One is the elemental composition, and we will be providing that. The other is the mineralogy,
right,
the mineral makeup. And you can have two rocks that have the same element composition that have different minerals, and the mineral makeup also tells you the history of the rock, just like the elemental composition does. But I'll give you one example that everyone knows about, and that is graphite that you have in your pencil and diamond.
Right.
Okay, they're both carbon, but they're very different forms of carbon, and they've been through a whole different geologic history if you were to find them out in nature. And so the rover has another instrument that does the mineral makeup. But in order to do that, they actually have to grab a sample of that rock and grind it up and put it inside the body of the rover to an instrument called ChemIN, which does the mineralogy by a method called X-ray diffraction.
Right. But I guess the benefit with ChemCam is that you can stand off several meters.
That's right. ChemCam is considered the remote sensing composition instrument for the rover, and so it's much faster, and you could say it's much more agile at targeting samples and getting these samples measured, because anything that has to be grabbed or analyzed by the arm will take much longer to do and is more energy intensive. So whereas some of the instruments expect to do, say, tens to hundreds of samples, with ChemCam we're really expecting to do thousands to over 10,000 samples over the course of the mission.
Oh, excellent.
And so that allows us to basically look around the rover anywhere and shoot at various different samples in a given day, rather than, say, making one sampling in a day or one sampling in a week.
So you talk about the utility of ChemCam to give you chemical composition and ChemIN for mineralogy.
That's right.
Obviously, there's a sort of synergy of having both instruments there. Are there other instruments on board that benefit from the presence of ChemCam?
Yes, Ray, and well, I would say all the instruments benefit from ChemCam, but we could put it together by saying there are two remote sensing or reconnaissance instruments on board the rover. One is ChemCam that we've talked about. Another is a set of stereo somewhat wide-range cameras that are called MastCam. Mm-hmm. And those binocular camera, if you want to call it that, will give us stereo vision. It will also be able to really look around in a better way than ChemCam. ChemCam only has a very narrow field of view. And so those cameras and composition instruments together will give us the reconnaissance that we need to tell us what's around the rover. Then as the rover drives to these interesting areas that it'll see, it will be able to use the arm to pick up or even to analyze in situ some of the samples. So there's a couple of instruments on the end of the arm. The two are APXS, which is a Canadian instrument,
right,
called Alpha Particle X-ray Spectrometry. So that is also a composition instrument, but it's actually more accurate for many of the elements than ChemCam is. But because you have to place the arm down to make the measurement, it'll make fewer measurements than ChemCam. Mm-hmm. And then to provide context there is a microscopic imager on the arm as well, and that is able to get smaller or I should say smaller features than the ChemCam imager as well, because you can place it right next to or right on top of it, just like a microscope. So those two instruments, the arm also has a drill and a scoop so that it can drill inside, get drill shavings, and look at those, and also to provide those samples for two instruments that are sitting inside the body of the rover. One of those we mentioned is ChemIN, that'll give us a mineral makeup. Another one is called SAM. And SAM is the biggest instrument on board the rover, and it stands for Sample Analysis on Mars, rather generic, but it actually takes the samples and it has an oven, it can heat them up, it can drive out gases that can go through a long capillary tube, so to speak, called a gas chromatograph. It can also analyze the gases just as they are. So it'll look for isotope ratios and also for the size of the molecules in some cases that are driven off by heating these samples up. And it can also analyze the atmosphere for the atmospheric composition, and in that way it's quite a versatile instrument. Then a few other instruments on board. There's a weather station that is actually provided by Spain, and it'll give us wind and temperature and humidity and UV radiation. Then there is a radiation monitoring device called RAD, and that monitors the radiation. And in fact, it's already turned on as we're cruising through space now. And so that'll actually help us understand what the environment is like potentially for humans someday. And there is an instrument called DAN, the Dynamic Albedo of Neutrons, that the Russians are providing. And that instrument will tell us if there are, say, an abundance of neutrons underneath the rover, for example, indicative of either clay minerals that might have some water bound to it or ice. And then there's also one other camera called MARTI, and that is a descent imager. Which will actually take pictures as the rover is coming down to the ground. And it could possibly be used, because it's still looking down at the ground after the rover lands, it could possibly be used after that as well. Okay. And I hope I've remembered all the instruments at this point.
But it's certainly a very comprehensive suite of different capabilities.
It's great. We have on the order of 10 times the weight of instruments this time around that we had in the previous generation of rovers. So that's a huge increase in capability.
Yeah, and it seems to cover a little bit of everything that you'd ever want to do.
That's a good description. Yeah. Yeah.
So in the case of ChemCam, where you're sort of doing this standoff remote sensing of the chemistry of rocks, is there also a utility in having sort of a combination of this data with the orbital assets that we still have in Mars to compare what you see at a broad scale to what ChemCam sees at this very fine scale?
Yes, and in fact, the orbiting assets have been used already to try to guide us to determining a landing site on Mars. And so there's been extensive imaging of some of these locations. We had it narrowed down to four sites for 3 years now. And then just last summer, we finally picked the final landing site. And now the orbiters have such good vision, they can actually see a rover on the ground on Mars. It's almost like a defense satellite in that respect. And so we can really see what's around the rover and maybe over the hill, so to speak, if the rover is in a little depression. And that'll help us plan, that really helps a lot with planning the traverse of where the rover should go. Mm-hmm. It helps us understand already how steep are some of the slopes at these at our landing site and what we're expecting to find. And there's also mineralogy instruments in the orbiting assets so that they are able to look at the optical spectrum and tell us if they think there's clay minerals there and so on. Part of why we selected the landing site we did.
So you have a group of scientists who are part of your instrument team. And what sort of science questions are they hoping to answer with this instrument?
Well, first of all, let me just mention that ChemCam is actually unique in that we have a binational science team in large part, but we also have an addition of several Canadians as well.
Right.
But almost half of our team is U.S. and almost half of it is French. And so those of us in the U.S. have been working on our French, and the French have been actually probably doing a better job on their English. And we're sort of really splitting this instrument half and half. The French built half of it, including the laser, and the U.S. built the other half. and we're actually going to be operating at almost half and half as well. So we'll be after things have settled down and we've characterized the instrument, then half of the time it'll be operated from an operation center in France and half the time in the U.S., with remote scientists chipping in as well. So, for example, several scientists at Western University and a few other places. So the science questions that the ChemCam team is looking at is really, let me say first of all that we're blended in to some extent with the larger rover team, mm-hmm. and so we're trying to answer questions as a whole group. But looking at the capabilities that the instrument has, we're just trying to basically map those to what the questions are of the landing site. And the landing site that was selected was a place called Gale Crater, which is a 150-kilometer-wide crater near the equator on Mars. And it looked as if this crater was at one point sort of filled in with sedimentary material. And it's a great amount of sedimentary material spanning 5 kilometers in depth or in height. So there's a big mound at the center of the crater. And so the rover team is going to land, or the navigation team, I should say, is going to land the rover in a smooth part of the crater. And then the rover team will be working to sequence science analyses with driving. And the driving will be, in general, headed towards this mound of tall sedimentary material where we can look at layers and layers and layers of sediments. But the specific questions that the science team is trying to answer is, first of all, to understand the habitability of Mars as a whole on a number of different scales, but we're looking to look into this sedimentary mound and see, for example, is there carbon in these sedimentary layers? Is there potentially organic carbon that we find anywhere on Mars? And maybe not quite on the surface, but maybe a little bit below the surface with our drill or with scuffing up material from with the rover wheels. Or looking into a crater that's already excavated the surface a little bit. We want to look into how much water was in this place. This crater is, of course, a depression, and there may have been a lake. And in fact, I think that there is evidence that there was potentially a lot of ice and maybe glaciation in this crater as well. And so those are all questions that address habitability as well. And then, of course, really bound up in this question of habitability is the whole idea of what is the climate history and what is the geological history of this area. And then one final question that is being asked is, what is the potential for humans in some point in the future on Mars as well?
Okay, in what sense?
In terms of looking at the radiation environment, which is a biggie, because mm-hmm. we have to make sure that humans can survive there for some amount of time. And then also, I think, looking at potential resources that could be used as well.
Excellent, which I'm sure ChemCam will be able to help.
Yeah, and then actually one other one is to look at potentially, you know, is the dust hazardous? Is there poisonous materials in the dust, et cetera? So we're going to look at things like the presence of beryllium or arsenic or lead and try to find out if they're at some low levels as well.
Okay. Well, that's certainly an interesting question to be looking forward to. And an exciting instrument to have on Mars.
We're very excited.
Yeah, and I think that we'll all be looking forward to seeing this thing start working in August.
Yes, yeah. Thanks, Ray.
Excellent.
It's been good to talk.
Yeah, thanks for talking to us.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So we've all just listened to Roger Weens, a PI of the ChemCam instrument on the Mars Science Laboratory, tell us about the instrument and the mission and some of the exciting possibilities that we have once this gets to Mars in a couple of months. Do we have any thoughts about the utility of this?
I certainly think it's very interesting that there's 10 different instruments. They all do these different things. They all work together. There's just an amazing amount of stuff that we can actually learn about Mars from this one mobile platform.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, there's definitely a very comprehensive suite of instruments on there that covers a whole variety of the kinds of things you'd want to look at if you could go there and look.
Also, it's really spectacular of how so many different countries have come together with different kinds of instruments to actually put on this laboratory to actually test different things.
Yeah, the international cooperation is always an interesting component and impressive.
Yeah, it's remarkable, too, because this isn't an international mission. It's a NASA mission,
NASA
right?
Mission.
And yet, you know, there's a Russian instrument and a Spanish instrument, and there are Canadian participating scientists, and there's French collaboration in ChemCam and more.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that even if only NASA is exploring Mars, everybody gets to explore Mars a little bit. I think, though, that the LIVS is an exciting development because we haven't had this before. This is the first time we've had a laser-induced breakdown spectrometer that we can actually land on Mars or anywhere and do the kinds of things you can do with an instrument like that.
Yeah, so can you tell us maybe why that is so exciting and different? Because a lot of people, I'm sure, aren't familiar with that kind of technology.
Right. Well, as Roger mentioned, you know, the LIVS allows you, first of all, I mean, I think perhaps the most important aspect is that you get composition information about the rocks without having to walk up or move up to the rocks and take a sample. You can actually get standoff composition. And robotics, where you have to move around in an unprepared environment like the surface of Mars, is very difficult. A lot of rocks are going to be inaccessible, even with the robot arm.
You did say there would be thousands of samples taken, as opposed to dozens or hundreds with the chem in. So
yeah, exactly. And so you can stand back from these rocks and take sample after sample after sample, and you don't have to worry about wearing out your wet chemistry lab. You don't have to worry about precisely positioning the robot, going through the long process of getting the robot up to the rock. You can stand 7 meters away, zap, take a picture, done.
Yeah. I just think it's really cool that we have a big robot running around the surface of Mars, blasting away at the surface with a powerful laser gun.
A nuclear-powered
H.G. Wells was wrong.
Robot.
We went there first, and we are blasting away at them.
That's right, yeah, with laser beams.
It's also interesting that it's going to land in a crater where we expect, especially in the walls of the crater, to have a different chemistry than what it might be at the bottom. So using such kind of instruments, we can learn a lot about different layers of the surface of the Mars as well.
Yeah, there seems to be a very long depositional history in that central mound of Gale Crater. I've heard it described as the longest exposed stratigraphic column in the solar system. So we may have a billion years of history to look at.
Yeah, and such instruments can be really, really helpful when you don't have to move much up to something and, you know, get information out of it.
Yeah, and, you know, we'll have the same instrument to compare its measurements across that whole stratigraphic column if the mission lasts long enough. And we may learn a great deal about the sequence of events that laid that down.
Yeah, just because Mars is dry and lifeless now doesn't mean it always was. And the clues would be right there to find.
Yeah, and I mean, there's every reason to believe that there was certainly water and other things going on that may have been helpful as an environment for life. And the chemistry of these rocks will tell us a lot about whether that was plausible.
It would probably also give you a time scale of the events that probably occurred using understanding this column of different time zone layers of the crater.
Well, exactly. And of course, that's going to be very difficult to build up, right?
Yeah.
But there are, you know, the clues are waiting there for us to look at.
Probably this is one of the main reasons why they selected this crater, especially having a huge space to land is really important where there are lesser amount of rocks to just make sure the lander doesn't screw up while it's trying to land. And also we wanted a place which is good to explore. You don't want to, you know, just land in a desert with nothing around, but you would rather have so much more to study if the, you know, if it's extended over a longer period, you probably have a lot more science to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And Gale Crater has been a notional target for a long time. But it's only with the advent of the kind of precision landing that MSL is supposed to do that we're able to get the landing ellipse small enough that it fits inside the crater.
Yeah.
Before this, they were just having to pick some large area of plains and hope that the robot didn't land on a rock.
And that landing sequence is pretty intense. I would suggest for our listeners to check it out on YouTube. If you Google or if you YouTube MSL EDL, you'll get a great 5-minute video of how this thing is supposed to land. And
is it parachutes or rocket descent?
Oh my goodness.
There is various stages. It's intense. And I can see how, you know, on I think it's August 5th or the August 6th when it's supposed to land, that those scientists are going to be holding their breath.
Yeah, that entry, descent, and landing sequence has got to go right if any of this stuff we're talking about with ChemCam is going to happen. Actually, I saw a press release last week about the latest status on MSL, and they were looking forward to that landing, and they said that the descent to Mars will, and I quote, use bold techniques.
I would say.
Yeah.
And we will be totally calm and composed during the entire process.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, they've described it as, you know, a few minutes of terror.
Yeah, 8 minutes of terror, yeah. I believe it's called.
That's right. And, yeah, I mean, this thing is going to be on a tens of kilometers a second interplanetary trajectory and coming to a halt on the surface of Mars after plowing through the atmosphere at that hyper dropping to super dropping to subsonic speeds.
Yeah.
That's not easy to do.
No.
Yeah.
It's a pretty incredible, the technology now that they're able to do it. And, of course, because it's so much bigger than the other two rovers, it's not able to use that same technology as the, I don't know if anyone has seen the videos for that, with the airbags that basically soften the blow as it... As
simply
they
dropping onto the land and bouncing to a stall.
Yeah, and this one, it's very different because it's so much bigger. So they weren't able to use that same technology.
No, and now they've got the powered descent right to a halt, to a hover. And then this plan to winch the robot down to the surface from the hovering rocket platform. You know, the motivation being that you don't want to carry that heavy rocket system around for the whole mission.
Right.
But that has not been done before. That's a very novel technique.
Yeah.
So
fingers crossed.
Yeah. You know, if only you could be there to watch it.
I know. Yeah. Wouldn't that be amazing? Are they not going to have some sort of camera or something going on
The orbiting spacecraft can resolve the landers, right? Perhaps it'll be in place to watch.
Yeah, I don't know what the plan is. They did it with Phoenix. They were able to catch it during the descent, but you got one picture of the thing coming down with the parachute.
It's not like you have an astronaut in the orbit with a camera recording.
Yeah,
the
next time.
There's no TV crew on the ground. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know.
They could have sent a camera beforehand, though.
It cost of only a few more billion dollars.
Talk about precision landing. Get it next to the camera. Yeah. That's hard.
Somewhere in the vicinity.
Somewhere in the vicinity.
We have high resolution.
Yeah. How many cameras would you need to make sure we get the whole landing ellipse on TV? That's hard. But, you know, but it's an exciting possibility, and we all hope that this goes well.
Right.
And we'll all find out from a couple of simple radio tones that say, yes, I'm alive.
Yeah.
We'll be eagerly looking for those tones in the early hours of the 6th of August.
Yeah.
Cheers, everyone around.
Yeah, we'll have to have a party. It's going to be at like 2 a.m., I think, Eastern time.
Something like that, yeah.
It will be, you know, in the middle of the night, but...
But so far it's looking good. The spacecraft seems to be healthy, and the latest trajectory correction was successful. So it should make it to Mars.
And he did say it's already taking readings?
Yeah, the radiation. The radiation instrument.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Already useful.
Yeah. Yeah, they're monitoring the radiation environment en route to Mars as a feed-in for, you know, what you would have to prepare humans for.
Right, and I found that really interesting that they were kind of thinking about that, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's do some... studies and measurements about, you know, what could affect humans, because hopefully that's what's going to be happening in the next however many years they're planning on.
Yeah, and Dr. Wiens made a similar comment about the chemical investigations they're doing, that they want to know whether the dust is toxic and whether, you know, the radiation on the surface is problematic for humans, whether this environment is suitable for sending astronauts.
Right.
And in fact, the landing system that we described, part of the reason for testing that out is so that we have a demonstrated capability to land very heavy things on Mars. Because human spacecraft will be very heavy.
Right. Much heavier than this.
Yeah, even heavier. That's right.
How much does this one weigh, he said?
A large car, a small car, right?
It's 900 kilograms, okay. Or just over that.
Yeah. I looked at a picture of it the other day because, you know, someone says, oh yeah, it's bigger than the other ones, and it didn't really clue into me. And then there's this picture on the internet that has all three of the rovers, and it's huge.
It's 2 meters tall. It's taller than a person.
Yeah. That's
impressive.
You know, they say, oh, it's comparable size to a mini, but I think it's actually...
It's big.
Bigger than that.
Certainly big enough to ride on.
Yeah, it's like it's comparable to a small car with the big mass standing up on top, even more.
The wheels are just... are huge.
What are they, like 50 cent? Am I right about that?
I just know it'd be fun to drive around on.
Yeah, it's very slow, though. I'll take it.
It's not like you're going off-road, you know. But you're alone.
Hey, you are off-road on Mars. That's pretty good.
Well, you're alone there. You don't have anyone to race with, so I mean, take your time.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point of this mission is to stop and smell the roses, right?
In detail.
Yeah, in great, fine detail.
Uber detail.
Yeah.
For now, how long is this mission scheduled to last for?
Nominally one Martian year, so 600-odd days, or roughly 2 Earth years.
But I'm guessing if it's similar to what happened with Spirit and Opportunity, if it's still going, then they'll just...
Let's hope so, yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly the power source, the radioisotope generator, has, in principle, many years of useful power in it, as long as all the mechanisms keep working.
Right. So, and that's something quite different from the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, which relied, was it solely on solar power?
Yeah, they had some little radioisotope heaters, but everything that mattered really was solar power.
Yeah, they had problems with the dust storms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So does this new power system then, are they able to use several instruments at once because of it, or are they still going to try to keep that to a minimum?
That's a complicated question. It's very difficult to speak to the idea of what they call interops, a simultaneous use of two different instruments. But what they can do with this system is they can run at night if they have to.
Mm.
And they can run kind of any time of the day that they want. They still have power limits, but they're, you have a broader envelope than you did with the solar power.
Now, because they're running at night, does that open up more doors for different types of measurements, for example, in the atmosphere that you wouldn't get during the day?
Yeah, there are... Various researchers have plans to do different things. The group that John Moores and company are involved with, looking at doing atmospheric work in the early morning, possible to look for fog formation, and this may well be before the sun comes up. So that's something that is partly enabled by having nuclear power and the ability to run at more or less any time of day, if the schedule of other instruments and the power budgets allow.
Mm.
So there's all kinds of possibilities for sure.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview with co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Parshati Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Raymond Francis, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough in time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.